I've got a couple of questions at the beginning of the sermon this morning. So when it comes to Byron Community Church, who are some of our missionaries? Can you think of names? You don't need to broadcast them out, but just think of some of the names of our missionaries at Byron Community Church. Second question, when it comes to Byron Community Church, who are our ministers? Think of names, kind of put them in that compartment in your mind. Who are some of our missionaries? Who are some of our ministers? I've got two signs for you. I'd like you to read those out aloud. The first word says sacred, and the second word says secular. I need two volunteers. Josh and Sarah, thank you for volunteering. Did you see their hands shoot up in the air? Sarah, you led the way, and Josh just followed. So I actually need to ask you a couple of questions. And I've got these two signs, sacred and secular. And I was thinking, when it comes to Byron Community Church, who has vocations, who have jobs that are sacred, and who has jobs that are secular? So, Josh, what is your official position when it comes to your work life? Oh, very neat. And you've been now, Josh, about 7 weeks, 8 weeks. It seems a lot longer. I think that's a good thing. It is a good thing. And I love Josh's work ethic. Well, Josh, given the fact that you work here, that you do great work in community outreach, we're looking forward to events that are coming up. We think of the way that you're helping out with DVBS that's going to be coming this summer. And hey, hot off the press, Church in the Park this summer is August the 28th. Mark it on your calendar. And the speaker amongst the churches of Byron this year is Joshua Kennedy. Wow, isn't that exciting? So Josh has that assignment. But Josh, by every indication, I would think you deserve this sacred label. And in fact, Josh, I think it would be appropriate you sit on our special chair, make yourself comfortable, contemplate what people who are sacred do. You do a lot of that. Sarah, you've been amongst us for a while now. Sarah, where do you work?
I'm an illustrator for General
Garnett. Oh, that's really neat. Now, in that job, I just want to make sure here. In that job, do you hand out tracts, gospel tracts, during the day? No? Oh. How about, have you arranged a small group Bible study at your lunch hour yet? Well, Sarah, I got to give you this label. It says secular, and I think this is quite adequate for you to sit on the on the stool. Now, Sarah, you just need to know in our imaginations that those times you're helping Josh do like the really important work of ministry, we do imagine that you could be sitting in this chair. But I think this is appropriate that Sarah gets to sit in the secular seat, on the secular stool, and Josh, you look very comfortable in that seat. So I'm going to ask for my labels back. Let's thank Josh and Sarah for this object lesson. Recently, somebody asked me the question, "So John, what does your wife do?" I wanted to answer, "Well, she breathes, she puts up with me," which is a major function. But I paused and I said to this fellow, "My wife is in ministry." He said, "Really? Is she like an assistant for you at the church during the week. She has a little office. I said, no. She's very supportive. She's very encouraging. But no, she doesn't work at the church during the week. And they said, ah, I get it. She works for a Christian organization. I said, well, you need to know, we've got people in our congregation who work at SEND and International Justice Mission and Compassion and but Trans World Radio. But I said, my wife doesn't work at any of those organizations. And the guy was really confused, and I thought, I'll help him out. I said, my wife is a teacher. And he says, oh. And that's as if a light bulb went off, and he goes, I get it. She teaches in a Christian school. I said, no. She teaches in a public school. I said, it's very much a mission field. And I said, both Heather and me regard her teaching as ministry. Did you follow that? That's a really big idea. And in fact, it's such a big idea that I would argue that these labels, sacred, secular, when it comes to a proper and good understanding of Scripture, to the extent that these labels present a gap or divide, these labels are not really helpful, or are they biblical? There is a British school teacher. I saw her interviewed the other day, Dr. Mark Green, who is a British pastor. And this teacher asked the question, she said, I'm just curious. She says, why is it that my church, when it comes to my Sunday school teaching, I have 5 children, I teach them 35 to 40 minutes once a week. Why is it that my church commissions me to that task, prays for me in that task, but never when it comes to what I do most of the week, where I am teaching over 25 children for over 40 hours a week? Said, I've never been commissioned. I don't believe I've ever been prayed for. And frankly, I really think that what I do most of the week doesn't really matter. I'm excited about our topic this morning, and I know that I'm going to intrude on your comfort zones. But I feel that what we have to present this morning is important and biblical. At the Moody Pastors Conference this year, we were privileged to have Dr. Daryl Bach there, one of my favorite New Testament scholars. For years and years, he has taught at the Dallas Theological Seminary, but his appeal goes beyond just those in that movement. He is a very formidable New Testament scholar. I would argue his work in Luke and Acts is phenomenal. It's about the best I have seen when it comes to scholarship in the book of Luke, Gospel of Luke, and the book of Acts. So when I was there, I was among a selected group of pastors who had the opportunity to sit with Dr. Bach during a luncheon, and believe it or not, his topic was Christians in the workplace. And then just a few days ago, I had the opportunity to listen to a presentation by Dr. Scott Ray. I've mentioned him before, another New Testament scholar. He works out of Talbot Seminary, affiliated with Biola University in California. Dr. Ray teaches philosophy, and he's done major work in the area, you guessed it, of Christians in the workplace. So I want to make sure that I'm giving proper and due credit to both of these men who I believe have influenced my thinking on our topic today. My title this morning is Vocation as Ministry. You can actually substitute your word for vocation. You could say work as ministry, my job as ministry, teaching as ministry, administration as ministry, nursing, doctoring, driving a bus, working on an assembly line, flipping hamburgers. Whatever the vocation, our title this morning is Vocation as Ministry. My subtitle, A Theology of Work. And behind me are some verses that we read, and I want you to look at these words very carefully. Serve wholeheartedly. Paul is talking to slaves. You need to know that Paul is not condoning slavery. He is acknowledging a institution, a way of life that existed. He actually has instructions that elevate the status of a slave, and Paul would be delighted to know that in the progression of history, slavery has generally been abolished. But slaves, back when Paul wrote to the Ephesians, slaves were the workforce. In fact, there were a lot of occupations that were under that banner of slavery. You had teachers, you had doctors, you had nurses, you had those who did menial tasks in homes, but you had a full range of people who are part of the workforce. That is why I believe Ephesians 6, 5 to 9, for our contemporary application, can definitely the teaching be applied to you and me and the workplace. In fact, I would argue in these verses that Paul is going to present to us a fine theology or ethics of work. But what grasped me as I've looked at these words in a very, very direct way over the last few days is that phrase, serve wholeheartedly. The word from the Greek that gets translated serve is the word diakonos. Now, you know that we often use it in a very role or position-mannered way. We get our word deacon or deaconess from that Greek word. Actually, if you look at the New Testament, the word is most often used functionally. And it means, quite literally, the word diakonos, to serve, and catch this. Now listen carefully. Connect the dots. Maybe the most literal meaning of that word diakonos is to minister. Is Paul writing to a group of pastors? No. Is Paul writing to what we would, in a very narrow traditional sense, call missionaries? No. He's actually talking to people in a very general way who are part of the workforce. The other thing I find incredibly challenging about this passage, and I've read it in every translation you can imagine, there is no mention of handing out tracts. There's no mention of having a small group Bible study in the workplace. Now, don't get me wrong. I think work can be a means to an end. You heard me, right? So, hey, you say, I work so that I have an opportunity to share my faith with colleagues. I work well so that I have an opportunity when a colleague needs some prayer to pray with them. But hear me carefully. In this passage, work is presented as the end. Working well matters to God. That's a big takeaway. I hope that you will say to yourself, wow, I've never really thought of my job in those terms. So what Paul has to say here applies to those of you who have jobs in the workplace. I think it has as much to do with those of you who are homemakers, who are working faithfully at doing laundry and changing diapers and all those fun things that constitute homemaking. I'd even say if you're retired and you've now ventured into a whole other realm of yard work and housework and other kind of work, and especially students who I would hope work hard at their studies, I make no apology. Our application this morning is intended to be very broad. Here's some of the problems that I have and why I believe that in 2016 we need a paradigm shift. Most of people's waking hours are spent in the workplace. If I was to ask you to think back over your last week, or those of you who are retired maybe need to think back longer ago, but many of you would agree with me. Most of our hours are spent in the workplace. And there is, sadly to say, a false perception that work out there is in that less than category when it comes to God's kingdom. We do have what I would call a ministry hierarchy. If I had lots and lots of time, I could try to give you a historical explanation for that. I believe you could go back even to the days of Augustine, where he seemed to put more emphasis on the contemplative as opposed to the active part of life. But if we were to trace where this hierarchy came from, it would be quite interesting and intriguing. And I must humbly say that for many people, when it comes to the hierarchy, pastors are up near the top, or our work is definitely considered sacred, it's considered important, it's considered significant. And in no way do I want to take away from that. I really appreciate the respect or honor that you would give to someone like Josh or me. Hey, missionaries are, and now when I say missionaries in the traditional sense of what we understand as missionaries. So those who are off in a far-off land, those who are serving in other places. I remember as a boy, missionaries to me belonged on the very highest pedestal. What I say today, I don't want to in any way undermine our support and encouragement of missionaries in that traditional sense. But when we allow our thinking to create some kind of hierarchy, that there's pastors, there's missionaries, and then there's a whole lot of people who are doing work that really isn't all that important, I think we end up with a major problem. It's why I do not like the term secular work, because I believe that everything we do should be regarded as sacred. So the problem with Christians and the workplace is it's a topic that's rarely addressed. It is often overlooked. Now, except this one person said the other day to me, only from a sense that those who work in the secular arena are the ones who have pockets to be picked, which is a very crass way of looking at how missions don't survive, or missionaries don't survive, unless they have support from those who are in the worker marketplace. You could say, and equally so with pastors, we rely on, we count on your faithful tithing. And so there is that sense on one hand that what you do in the marketplace or the workplace is got that so that missionaries and pastors who are doing the important work are getting supported. And I want to try to take that away, that notion. A young fellow said to me the other day, I left my business to serve the Lord full time. I cringe when I hear that. I remember when I left the business banking world, legitimately a sense of calling, but I had people who gave that notion. But isn't it wonderful that John is now entering into the Lord's work, full-time service? My argument today is your job, your work is full-time service. And I want to try to shift that paradigm for for us this morning. What do we do with guys like Tom Chappell, who owned his own business, very successful in the northeastern United States, and decided that he needed to look at where his life was headed, and he took a year off to attend the Harvard Divinity School. At the end of the year, he had a choice. Did he return to business, or did he enter into the pastorate? Tom Chappell decided to do what the Lord was directing him to do. He went back into his business, a very successful business in the northeastern states. Several years ago, as a young guy, I had an opportunity to meet a really cool guy from out west. He came to Toronto and was an actuary student in Toronto. Sharp, nice guy. He ended up moving back out west, and I lost contact with him until, randomly, out of the blue, I got a call here at the church, and this fellow said that he and his family were moving into London, and kind of the rest is history. The fellow who moved in was Murray Taylor, and some of you know the name Murray Taylor. Did you know about Murray Taylor, that while he was raising up the ranks with Great West Life and Investors Group, Murray took a year off to go to Bible college. He went to Mount Carmel Bible College, a sister school, the school I taught at, Kawartha Lakes Bible College. And at the end of that year, Murray made a decision. Did he become a full-time pastor? No. He stayed with Great West Life, and as many of you know, he's just retired, by the way. Maybe that's news to you. Just a few days ago, he's retired as CEO of Investors Group. And I know from some contacts I have in Winnipeg that he has served the Lord very faithfully in that context in Winnipeg. Did he do something that was lesser? Did he do something that's not quite as significant as what I do or what some of our missionaries do? We need to shift our paradigm. Let me just give you some fast Bible observations when it comes to work. Work itself has intrinsic value. Work itself is important. I love to ask students when I was at the college, so where do we have the work mandate? Is it in Genesis 1, 2, or Genesis 3? You'd be surprised how many said, work is a penalty. Work is a curse. Boy, oh boy, people get up in the morning and go, thank you, Adam and Eve, for what you created. I got to go to work again. Where do we find the mandate for work? It's in Genesis, well, specifically, it's in Genesis 2. It's part of the creation mandate. Paradise past includes work. And hear this clearly. Paradise future is going to include work. Some of you are going, oh no. No, you won't be floating around on a cloud playing a harp for eternity. Maybe some of you will do that sometime as part of your work in heaven. But I can imagine some of the work that we're going to be doing in heaven. Will it be related to the kind of work maybe you're doing now? It could be. Maybe some of us will be doing some kind of work that we weren't able to. I'm going to see if I'll get a job assembling some stuff in heaven. Won't that be incredible? And you're going to walk by me in heaven and paradise, and you're going to go, wow, I cannot believe what heaven is like. Our God is a working God. You hear that? He is a working God. Work, what, 6 days, rest on the seventh? Jesus said, I have come to do my Father's work. We are created in the image of God. And I would argue that you are wired, I am wired to work. Whether that's in the marketplace, at home, as a student, you are wired. You have a DNA, a God-ordained DNA. That stimulates that kind of work. In Ecclesiastes, we're told that we're to find satisfaction in work, and we're to do our work well. If you teach math, teach it well. If that gives you an opportunity to hand out a tract or form a prayer group, that might happen. But fundamentally, if you are a teacher, teach well. If you are flipping hamburgers at a hamburger joint, flip those hamburgers well. If you are a student and you're going, does anybody care? Does anybody notice? Learn well. Study hard because it matters to our God. Good work can be a means to an end, but here in Ephesians 6, it's presented as an end in itself. Work itself needs to be seen as service to Christ. One of the most practical ways we show love and support to our family, to our neighbor. Jesus said, the great commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. You love as you serve, as you do what is necessary to help others. I, the other day, was looking at that little flake of Just Right. You know the cereal Just Right? And I thought to myself, wouldn't it have been something if I got up this morning and I said, okay, it's up to me. All the production, everything that's necessary to come up with this flake of Just Right. And I got thinking of all the people who contributed to that flake of Just Right. There's a farmer, right, who sowed the seed, who reaped his crop. There's production. There's the truck that goes from the farm to the production facility, and there's people working on an assembly line. Somebody made the Just Right box, right, that the cereal goes into. And then from there, it goes to some kind of wholesale facility. It goes on the grocery store shelf, and there's a guy who's shelving the cereal. And then there's the cashiers who are helping me buy the cereal. And after a while, I thought, there's got to be over 100 people who help produce this flake of Just Right cereal. That's why I hope you're thankful for farmers. I hope you're thankful for people who make that possible. Can you imagine years ago where it would have been up to you? Heard another really good story. There was a pastor, and he and his wife were over in England, and all of a sudden his wife collapsed and went into seizure. They took her into the hospital and discovered that she had a tumor on her brain, and it required immediate surgery, and it was the type of tumor and it was the type of surgery that was quite groundbreaking. And they had come up with some computer programming and that made that operation something that could be done and a success. And this is what the pastor said after the fact as his wife recovered and was restored to health. He said, I'm so glad that if that software technician designer was a Christian, am I ever glad that that person had not left his or her job to serve the Lord full time. Now again, think of what I said earlier, that I don't like that division, that there's those jobs that are sacred or secular. All jobs, all work should be regarded as full-time service. So quite frankly, it has to do with our vocabulary. I think we need to strike out the phrase full-time ministry. If you're a teacher, you are in full-time ministry. If you're a homemaker, you are in full-time ministry. If you are on an assembly line, you are in full-time ministry. Agreed? Secular jobs. I do not like that phrase. You say, well, but John, it helps us to... Well, yes and no. To me, that term secular has a less than connotation to it. And most definitely, you can accuse me of letting my brethren background have an impact here, but there is no room for any kind of hierarchy of ministry. Please respect and honor me as your pastor, but don't put me on a pedestal. Okay? I believe in the priesthood of all believers, what all of us are doing has matters of significance. So here's some very quick implications, all taken out of this passage behind me. If what I'm saying is true, then it has implications in these areas. When it comes to our preaching, when it comes to my preaching, and the others who participate here in preaching, we need to put effort into application that is relevant when it comes to where most of our people spend most of their time. We need to be asking the question, what does this mean to that person in his or her workplace? Ethical issues. I can't think of an arena in your life where there are more ethical issues. In business, in medicine, in teaching, in business. And a good pastor needs to push himself and say, how does this apply? What is this principle? What is this command going to mean for that person in the workplace? Relational conflicts. You might have one or two here at our church, but my guess is where you're spending a whole lot of time with a whole lot of people is likely where there's a greater potential for relational conflict. Tough choices. Have any of you had any tough choices in your workplace recently? And from a standpoint of how we equip you and how we come alongside you, it has to have an impact on how we preach. Commissioning, my hobby horse. So Daryl Bach, I happen to be sitting at the table with him. He is a cool guy, very knowledgeable, very humble, great conversation during lunch. He gets up, he does his presentation, and then as he's talking about Christians in the workplace, he says, now how many of your churches have a commissioning coming up? And I thought, yes, AOK commissioning, June the 26th. I hope you're looking forward to it. And so my arm just shoots up there. There are a few other guys, but my arm is up high. Yes. We're having a commissioning for the AOK team. Then he said, okay, those of you who have your arms up, how many of you have a commissioning scheduled for young people who are going to be flipping hamburgers this summer, for young people who are going to be working on an assembly line? How many of you have had a lot of commissioning recently for some of your teachers, some of your doctors, some of your accountants, some of your lawyers? Folks, my arm went up really fast, and then it started to, and it was painful. You know that I've actually pushed on this, but I thought, I likely haven't pushed enough. Now, you heard me right. Should we be excited about commissioning the AOK team? Okay, that's not enough enthusiasm. Should we be excited? Will you be here June 26th? Because I don't want this message misunderstood. But we send out the wrong message if we do that picking and choosing in terms of who or what we commission. And the reality is there are some significant mission fields. There are some young people who might be going, I guess what I'm doing this summer doesn't matter. It doesn't count because it's not spiritual enough. Is that the message we want to convey? Not at all. So to me, a very practical tool. We got to think it through, but we need to be very intentional about commissioning all our missionaries, all our ministers. Who are our missionaries? You are. Oh, we have some who are in foreign places, other places in the world, but you are to fulfill the mission of God where He has put you. Who are our ministers? If it's only Josh and me, we're in trouble. Actually, I see one of my roles is equipping you for ministry. And in that way of looking at it, most definitely you are our ministers. And yes, this topic has lots of implication for missions. I'm thrilled that I'm seeing a shift in the missions world. for long entrenched in very traditional thinking, and you're seeing some advances. Believe it or not, just yesterday, I open up my email to an invitation from a fellow named James Coolidge. Alicia got your attention, didn't I? You know that fellow. So Alicia's dad, and he's inviting people to a luncheon at Youth for Christ called Growing Your Business. And I had to catch myself. My first instinct is, what does this have to do with missions? Wait a second. I'm actually preaching on this topic tomorrow. It has everything to do with it. Good for Youth for Christ to be doing that kind of thing. But you know what's happened in the missions world? Some may regard it as a problem, but now our missionaries have to be equipped with certain skills and abilities, right? So now they have to be able to teach English as a second language. Have you ever heard of a missionary going over operating a business in a foreign place? Have you ever heard of Vic and Andrea Stutzman? I mean, I could give you a list of what I see. Actually, what we may see as a problem is actually an opportunity and maybe more in fitting with how our God regards work. My dream is one day to see a missions conference right here at Byron Community Church titled Vocation as Missions. There's a challenge for those of you who are on our missions committee. Sign me up. I'll be in the front row. I think it would be a wonderful approach. Let me push the envelope even further. This has implications for discipleship. The reality is we might have you for an hour and a half here in this building to do discipleship. Did you ever think that the workplace or the marketplace is an arena for discipleship? Think this one through. Okay, come with me on this little journey. Think about the last two or three work weeks for you at work. Can you do that? For some of you, you've got big smiles. For some of you, you go, I'm here today to escape the last two or three weeks. But think of those last two or three weeks. My question is, where does God fit into what you have experienced in the workplace? How he's molding you, how he's shaping you through the challenges of the workplace or the marketplace. Is God capable of doing that? Do you think God is saying, I've only got you in this building for an hour, but boy, I've got you in the workplace for 40, 50, some weeks maybe even 60 hours. Wow, is that liberating to say to yourself, maybe God, in his wisdom, is doing something remarkable in the workplace. Can I also add this? I know that mentoring in the workplace has become very popular. Heather is a mentor in the schools, and wonderful. Melissa, a young business executive, is a mentee, I guess you call them, right, Melissa? And I was thinking to myself, wouldn't it be wonderful, wouldn't it be great synergy to see a Christian who has experience in the workplace mentoring a younger person who's coming along and can talk to them about some of the implications and some of the impacts and some of the learnings. And maybe I'm thinking way outside of the box, but I become more and more convinced that maybe the workplace, the marketplace, is a greater context for discipleship than we realize. Then the last thing I want to mention, which kind of scares me a bit, is implications in the area of economics. Yes, Don, I said the word economics. I did study some economics in university. I know the difference between micro and macroeconomics, and I can still draw a pretty good supply and demand graph. I don't even know why that's properly called, but can you believe Scott Ray the other day was saying every pastor should have some familiarity with the area of economics? He said one of the challenges when it comes to interpreting scripture is some of the economics that was there back in Bible times. In fact, there's a strong sense of economic injustice in Bible times that I think permeates particularly through the Old Testament. A little hint, When you look at some of the prophets and minor prophets, you can't avoid the issue of economic injustice. You get into Jesus' teaching in the Gospels, and even here with Paul, that issue of economic injustice is a pretty big one. And then you go back to the fact that in Bible times, the notion would have been that there's one pie. And in order for you to get a bigger slice of the pie, it means that somebody has to get less of the pie. Until in about the 1800s, some economists came along and said, hey, maybe the idea is we need a bigger pie. Isn't that exciting? Because a bigger pie means that, hey, I'm striving for a bigger slice, but it's possible for you to have a bigger slice of the pie. And that whole sense of economic justice that permeates through Scripture likely necessitates that we think in those kind of terms. When Jesus says, love your neighbor, he is thinking of those who are poor and marginalized. How is my approach at work having an impact on the well-being of other people? And that to me is something that's very exciting when it comes to the workplace. And then finally, and I put this under economics, where we're thankful for the service and the work of others. Are you thankful for those people who serve you in a restaurant? I've been with some Christians who have treated a server in an appalling way. And I go, what's that about? We should be setting a standard. Because I know that our Lord wants us to treat others with respect and with dignity. And no job, no service is beyond his attention. We're going to close with ethics. And that brings us back to the Ephesians chapter 6 passage. I see three R's. I'm going to just address them really quick. This passage behind me is about rendering. There's the first R, rendering wholehearted service. Work well, work hard. I'm a great believer in hard work. Yes, you need rest. There has to be balance. But boy, roll up your sleeve when it's called for and work hard. Serve wholeheartedly as if you were serving the Lord, not men. It's not that you're not serving men, but you're seeing beyond men and women. You're going, hey, I'm doing this and it matters to the Lord. Even changing those diapers matters to the Lord. Even that yard work, even studying that extra half hour, it matters to the Lord. And look at here, because you know that the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does. And I don't minimize or put a narrow definition to good. Did you catch that? Hey, good works that are redemptive in nature are wonderful and are necessary, but sometimes we'll just do good works because we're to do good works. And so whatever it is, do it. And then we read that the Lord rewards everyone. Maybe when the Lord says, well done, good and faithful servant, will that comment go to those who led 100 people to Christ? Absolutely. But it may also go to someone who taught math well. The Lord goes, you know what? The way you taught, the way you worked on that assembly line, the way you served your customers, well done, good and faithful servant. So render wholehearted service. Let's go to the next slide, Ken. Slave or workers, obey your earthly masters with respect, with fear, with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Respect your supervisor. Respect your boss. Easier said sometimes than done. Have you ever worked for a boss that's hard to respect? Nobody's going to put up their arm, and I don't blame you. But you might go, John, this doesn't make any sense. You should know that supervisor I have, or that coach, or that principal, or respect. The fear and reverence there to me connotates the idea of compliance. You say, but what about somebody who's a bit harsh or difficult? Isn't it interesting that Paul's friend Peter says in a related passage, even if your master treats you poorly, you're still to respect that person. And if I can go out on the limb a little bit, if you're a Christian, you should have a reputation at the workplace as the man or woman who respects his supervisor. If you're a Christian athlete, you should have the reputation of the one who respects and honors those who are his coaches. If you're in a school, you should be seen as one who has that kind of respect for his or her supervisor. It doesn't mean this person is better than you. In fact, often the Lord puts someone and you're going, what's this about? Remember what I said last week about the police officer? When the police officer pulls me over, I don't go, well, I think I have more education than you. I am definitely older than you. No, he's been assigned that position. He or she has that authority. And God says, I want you to respect that. I'm a God of order. And so in this instant, we are to render wholehearted service. We are to respect those who have authority over us. And then finally, next slide, Ken. Oh, sorry. Let's go back. Verse 6, obey them not only to win their favor when their eye is on you, but like slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. Paul does something really neat here. He takes a couple of Greek words, puts them together. So my point here is, refuse to do eye service. And my definition of eye service is only working hard when others are watching you. Does that make sense? So render wholehearted service. Respect those in authority over you. And then the third R is refuse to do eye service. You ever seen someone that's their ethic to work? The boss is out. She's not coming in today. Wow, I can kind of let up. I don't need to work hard, or I can take extra long on my lunch. You've already heard me preach on why Christians shouldn't take sick days if they're not sick, why we should push for a very high ethic. And here Paul would be saying, don't do eye service, and if you need some motivation, God knows what you're doing. I go back a number of years ago. I'm a teenager, and a couple of us guys are helping out at the church, and we're doing some painting. And we're painting a corner of the basement in the church building. And I remember distinctly saying to my friend Keith, Keith, I don't think this really matters. Who is ever going to see this corner in the basement? And at that point, old Mr. West, a retired shop teacher, who is our supervisor, was walking by. He was a bit of a gruff fellow, but had a good heart. And Mr. West, who obviously had heard my comment, as he's walking by, said, boys, God sees all. That's all he said. I still remember it going, whoa. But I thought, hey, it matters. And I know there's work that's trivial that you might go, does it matter? Where does it fit? Don't do eye service. Be someone who gives his or her full effort by the grace and mercy of God. Now, Ken, we can go to the last slide, because we do have some today who are bosses, supervisors, leaders. So here's a little word for you. Treat your workers in the same way. So just as a worker is to show you respect, you need to treat those under your employ with respect and dignity. And then don't threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him. I love that teaching. Hey, you've been put into a position of leadership. You're a supervisor. You have people who are working under you. But from God's perspective, there's no favoritism. He regards the person pushing the mop, the night custodian, in the same way he regards the CEO of the company. And if you are the CEO, if you are the supervisor, if you are the boss, the message here is treat others as God would want you to treat them. You need, as a supervisor or a manager, to ensure that it's a better work environment, that actually people are excelling and are passionate about their job, and that you're having a part in that. And last week, remember, we talked about a husband being a servant leader? I would argue here, long before it became a popular, trendy way of thinking, Paul is saying, if you're a supervisor, if you're a manager, be a servant leader. What I want to do now, if you are a worker in the public domain, if you're a doctor, if you're a nurse, or if you're a teacher, I'd like you to stand now. Don't be bashful. Stand now. Doctor, teacher, if you are in the business world, whatever that may look like, you sell stuff, you manage stuff, you are in computering, I want you to stand now. Anybody in the business world? Sarah, you get to stand now. If you are a homemaker and you know what it is to work hard and you give yourself diligently to that, whether you're younger or maybe a bit older, you can stand. If you are a student who should be working very hard at his studies, right, Mark? If you are a student, you get to stand. All the young people, you should be standing. If you are retired, you spent a lot of years working really hard and you're at that stage of life where you still work but in a different kind of way, if you're retired, please stand. Is there anybody not standing? If I've missed you, Josh, you could stand. Those of us who are actually at the low end, who should be encouraging our ministers, I'm going to pray for you. Father, help us not to have narrow thinking when it comes to work. Our work matters. Father, help us to work in a way that brings honor and glory to you. Father, I thank you for the opportunities we have to fulfill your will. God, I pray for each person in the arena that you have put him or her into. And let us strive in all things to bring our God glory. For Jesus, it's in your name we pray. Amen. Will you stay standing for our next song?
And at this time, the youth can be dismissed for their class.
When we walk with the Lord in the light of His Word, what a glory He sheds on our way. While we do His good will, He abides with us still, and with all we will trust.
Trust and
sin.